The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're having a long overdue conversation with Dr. Hans Reinemer, who is the head of the pediatric dentistry program at Primary Children's Hospital. Welcome back, Hans.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Where are you from originally?
Born in California, but spent most of my childhood in Anchorage, Alaska. And then left the great state of Alaska to attend the University of Utah and then bounced around for school. But been now in Utah longer than I've been anywhere else. And so I think this is home.
It starts to accrue, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Residency. Have you acquired any conflicts that you want to disclose before we start talking today?
No, no conflicts.
So what we want to talk about this week, last week we talked about the sort of basics of cavities, which is, I think sometimes we think of that as being sort of the heart and soul of dentistry, but it's much more complicated than that, right? There's a lot going on in dentistry and there's a lot that goes on with your relationship with patients.
Right. Absolutely. We talk a lot about prevention. Obviously we're looking at the health of the dentition. Are there cavities or are there no cavities? But we're looking at the oral health of the child as a significant component of systemic health. And so there's a lot of discussions that we can have beyond whether or not that your child has cavities.
Excellent. Well, let's get started. So last time we talked about the importance of establishing a relationship with a dentist at about 1 year old, both for relationship building as well as for anticipatory guidance and to get a general look at how teeth are surviving in there. What else do you talk about at that visit?
So our goal is on that first visit, again, one thing that we mentioned last time is we're not really planning on doing anything. We're going to do a quick exam, but there's a long list of anticipatory guidance topics that should be addressed. And it's important for parents to be aware of these as they go in. And one of the first things we're going to talk about is just the risk level of this particular child. What is their risk of developing dental decay? We talked a little bit last time about what some of those high risk factors are, socioeconomic status being the number one, but we're also going to be looking at protective factors. Like, is your child receiving an optimal amount of fluoride? Is your water fluoridated in the community? Are you getting fluoride through toothbrushing? Are you seeing the dentist on a regular basis, or should we now start seeing the dentist? These are all the protective factors. And then we're also looking at disease indicators. Are we identifying any early demineralizations, white spot lesions? Are there active dental cavities that would need to be addressed? And things like that. But so that's a little bit about how we started last time we talked. We're going to obviously look at the teeth, but there's a lot of other things that we want to assess as well.
Brief side note, you and I have both practiced in this state for a while, both before and after addition of fluoride to the water. It has seemed to me that it makes a real difference. Has that been your impression as well?
Yes and no. I mean, I think overall we have seen an improvement in the cavity rate for a good number of children, but within that high risk population that we previously discussed, mm-hmm. the low socioeconomic status, I don't see any benefit. And so what that means is that there's much more to this puzzle than just fluoridating the water. There's a lot that goes into it. And that's why it's important to talk a lot about different topics, just to make sure that the oral environment's as healthy as it can be.
Right. So what you do overlaps with what I do quite a bit because there are a lot of things about normal child development that have an effect on teeth. What sorts of growth and development topics are important for you?
Yeah, so when I'm sitting down with a parent and we've just conducted a little infant oral exam, or whether it's a 2 or 3 year old, one of the most interesting questions that were the things that engages them the most is what's next, especially for a first time parent, like when's the first tooth coming in and when's the first tooth coming out and what's next? The eruption sequence of primary teeth is a little unusual because you tend to get incisors first and then you skip to go to the molars and then you come back to get the canine. So that's normal, but that panics a lot of parents because they don't understand why is my child missing teeth. So just talking through the growth chart with parents about what they can expect as their child develops is huge. And then as they get older, that's going to morph into when should my child see the orthodontist? Because starting at 6, 7, primary teeth are coming out. Okay, here come the permanent teeth. Oh my goodness, everything's so crowded. How is this possibly going to work? When do I go see the orthodontist? And so pediatric dentists spend a lot of time dealing with dental decay, but we're also very in tune with growth and development. And if you don't have a relationship with an orthodontist already, we're very good about letting you know, is it time? Should we wait a year? Whatever. So all of these eruption and exfoliation sequences are talked about a lot. And when we start working with our orthodontic providers. And then teething is a big subject too. You know, you always have the poor mom that comes in and they haven't slept in a week and my baby's teething and they have a temperature and oh my gosh, what can I do? And so, you know, we're there to give tips there as well.
Do you get a sense for how painful teething is?
It's all perspective. The mother claims that the poor child is dying because, you know, they're crying all the time and it's uncomfortable, right? But there are things that you can do. Some of the things that we do are just recommend cold compresses. What I did with my kids was freeze bagel wedges that they could kind of gnaw on. I think the comfort comes from something that's cold and something that can just massage, you know, mm-hmm. the area. But one of the biggest misconceptions is that it spikes fevers, and there's no scientific evidence to demonstrate that teething causes fevers, but they do happen coincidentally sometimes. Keeping the area clean helps, but it's mostly just palliative care and reassurance for most parents, and most kiddos get through it fine.
You know, it's interesting because I ask kids who are getting, you know, their third molars or kids who are getting replacement teeth, how much does that hurt? And their answer is usually, how much does what hurt? And it's not clear to me how painful teething is. It almost seems more like it's normal behavior that we're looking at. How do you feel about the topical analgesics for teething?
Yeah, not recommended. The problem is something like Orajel, for example, contains benzocaine, and benzocaine is pretty high percentage. And so it works for very limited minutes, and you certainly don't want to use it all day because you could potentially get into some anesthetic toxicity issues on an infant. You know, obviously for young infants, we're talking about methemoglobinemia issues, but, you know, that's going to not be an issue as they get a little bit older, but it's just the concentration, it's topical, it washes away very quickly. So honestly, some Tylenols and some Motrins and keeping the area clean is the best thing for them.
And cold stuff to chew on. Okay, let's dive into a controversial topic. What about thumb sucking?
Yeah, thumb sucking. So thumb sucking and pacifiers are very common. We certainly don't discourage it. We can't, because if a child's going to do it, they're just going to do it.
Almost every child is born with two thumbs, and so they're attacked.
That's right. So non-nutritive sucking is the term that we apply to the use of a thumb or a binky, and it's perfectly normal. It's comforting for a lot of young ones. If they're going to do it, that's going to be their choice, and there's not much we can do to intervene. We only want to intervene if it extends too long, and the reason for that is if they do it beyond a certain age, then it can potentially cause some issues with the position of their teeth. And so we like to see the binkies gone by a couple of years of age, because it's just, we don't want it to affect their speech development. We don't want it to affect the position of their teeth. Thumbs are a little bit tougher to stop at that age. 4 or 5, most kids will stop on their own, simply because I think they start showing up at preschool and recognizing that they may be the only one with a thumb in their mouth. And so I think peer pressure can be positive in some ways to get them to stop.
Do you have any secrets for helping kids stop thumb sucking?
There's a couple of things that we recommend. Most kids, in my experience, only do it during the day. A lot of them will do it at night. But if you do have a child that's doing it at night, one thing that's a very easy thing to implement is a glove or a sock on the hand of the thumb that they suck. And if you just sort of secure it so that they can't pull it off at night, if you can train them to not suck their thumb at night, oftentimes that carries over to the day, making them aware, potentially a reward system. I mean, those are all things that can be easily tried at home. Some parents have tried, there's some products that you can paint on the thumb that are supposed to taste nasty, but my experience is those don't work very good. They suck it off. They know it's going to be bad for a couple of seconds, but then they're good to go. So I've never had any success with those. You know,
Temperate is stronger than taste.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that we do if they start pushing 4.5, 5 is we can make some orthodontic appliances that act as a physical barrier. I actually did one of those on my own children and it worked really effectively. But most kids grow out of it by 4 or 5. Sometimes we have to intervene, but recognize that, you know, it is there for comfort. And if the child is not ready to stop on their own, there's nothing you can do to intervene.
Okay. And then you introduce them to an orthodontist.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So what can you tell me about feeding?
Yeah. So this is probably the biggest, most important discussion we have with parents when they come into the office is what role does nutrition and diet play in the development of dental decay? And so if you're starting with a 12-month-old, we're going to talk a lot about nursing. And mama's milk is great stuff, right? We don't want to discourage nursing. But once a child is of age where they're going to start adding sugars in addition to that, then we need to have a discussion about how often and what it is actually that you're, you know, putting in your mouth. I think parents need to know that it's not the food that causes dental decay, it's the feeding. And most importantly, and this is the message that I share with all my other healthcare providers and parents, is it's frequency that's the most important thing. In dentistry, we utilize as a demonstration model something called the Stefan curve. And so a normal pH is about 7, 7.2. And every time you put something in your mouth, the pH of your mouth turns more acidic. And the critical zone is 5.5. And so if you put something in your mouth and you feed the bugs, the bugs produce the lactic acid, the acidity increases. And the longer the pH is in a unfavorable zone, the more risk you have for developing dental decay. So we just don't want to feed kids all day. We call it grazing. Don't let your kids graze, because if you're constantly feeding the bugs, your pH is constantly acidic and increases the risk of dental decay.
So it's the bacteria that are making the atmosphere more acidic.
It's the bacteria that feed on the sugar that you give them, but it could potentially also be the acidity of what you're consuming. So that's that's where sodas come into play, because not only do you have sugar, you oftentimes have the added acidity. So that is a double whammy with some of those things.
Sure. The acidity being because it's carbonated. And so there's
either
citric acid or gotcha. Okay.
All right. So I hope that makes sense as a way to maybe sort of make it easier to understand. If you were to eat one meal a day, your pH would go from 7 down under 5.5, and it would stay there for about 30, 40 minutes. And then the saliva buffers the acids, and then your normal pH is restored. You'd be at risk for decay for 30 minutes a day if you had one meal a day. Now, if you're grazing and you're eating all day long, your pH stays down there all day long. And so that's why it's important to eat 3 square meals a day and maybe a snack, but just don't let your kids have constant access to snacks or sugar liquids.
What's the dental perspective on night nursing?
Night nursing is fine up until the first 12 months, but it's when you start adding additional sugars through other dietary sources that comes into play. And so during that first 12 months, you're probably not going to get into an issue, but beyond 12 months, when they're starting to add other things, at-will nursing at night increases the risk pretty dramatically. So by 12 months of age, we would like to see parents eliminate at-will nursing. Babies can get through the night at 12 months. They don't need to eat at that point. And so if they feel like they need something, give them a bottle and fill it up full of water. It gives them the comfort, but the water is not going to cause any issues. So at-will nursing at night becomes very dangerous, because at night you're not producing as much saliva. You may not be swallowing as frequently. And so the liquids tend to pool on the mouth and really go to town. So nighttime feeding is very dangerous.
Well, the interesting thing there too is the intersection between keeping your teeth healthy and also encouraging self-soothing skills at an age where kids are starting to get more separation fear. There's probably some advantage in not night grazing, especially in the second year of life.
Right, right. The common question that comes up is, well, my child needs to nurse or have a bottle right before bed. That's the only way that I can get them to sleep. That's great. My job is not to tell you how to feed your baby, but what I can do for you is modify the sequence. So what I tell parents is the last thing I want to see in your kid's mouth at night is a toothbrush. Mm-hmm. So if you feel like you need to nurse or give your baby a bottle before they go to bed, do it. just do it in the right order. So feed them, then do the toothbrush, and then go to bed. Oftentimes what happens is they brush their teeth and then they nurse at night. You haven't really done anything there. So just modify the sequence. And so the mom and the baby are satisfied, but so are we as dentists.
Does the feeding method make a big difference? So if a child takes a bottle at bedtime and then brushes their teeth, is that still good for dental health?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Because I get the impression looking at Utah soda shops that everyone's on a bottle all the time now. Everyone is sucking on something and comforting themselves.
No, and it's crazy because we not only see milk in a bottle, I've seen soda pop in a bottle, I've seen fruit juices in a bottle. It's kind of amazing what I see kids walking around with their bottle. And it's just, again, it goes back to the frequency. You're constantly feeding the bugs in your mouth. So your cavity risk is through the roof if you're walking around with a bottle of anything other than water. So once kids get to the age where they can use a sippy cup or a bottle between meals, it should just be just water, because then it gives them the comfort of having it, but it's not increasing the dental risk.
You've probably seen the advertisements from the early 20th century for products like 7-Up being ideal for feeding your kid. I think you may argue otherwise.
Yes, yes, for sure.
So what snacks do you recommend?
There are a lot of, first of all, so when it comes to snacking, you know, kids are hungry. I get it. So 3 meals a day, there are healthier snacks than others. For example, cheese is a wonderful snack because there's no sugar. Cheese actually stimulates salivary flow. And so if you can increase salivary flow, for example, that's going to help buffer any acids that you do have in your mouth. Other snacks, there are obviously sugar-free candies or snacks would be beneficial. There's some evidence to demonstrate that xylitol, which is one of our artificial sweeteners, actually does a fair job with cavity risk. Fresh veggies are good. Dark chocolates, interestingly enough, can be better than milk chocolates. The amount of sugar is less. So those are just some ideas. Again, if you're going to give your kiddo a piece of chocolate, for example, just do it at mealtime. Have them eat their healthy lunch as much as you can. Give them their little treat then, because you already have the acid attack underway. Don't do it in between everything else, because again, then you're just dropping your pH down.
Gotcha. What are some general oral hygiene tips for parents?
So again, going back to the bottle or sippy cup, make sure that at night, they're only getting access to water. Encourage brushing as soon as teeth come in. Again, you can start with a wet washcloth with infants, a 2x2 gauze that's moistened. Once kids get to the point where they can do a little bit more, definitely introduce infant toothbrushes. Look for small, soft toothbrushes. You definitely want to use a little bit of fluoridated toothpaste. The message there is just make sure that it's the quantity that you're paying attention to, because young children, toddlers, don't have the same ability to rinse and spit that we do. So we don't want them swallowing excess amounts of toothpaste. And so the general rule is for an infant or a small toddler, a schmear, which is just basically just a little wipe on the brush. Once they get to the age where they can kind of spit a little bit, maybe a pea-sized amount, and then once they get to the age where they can thoroughly rinse and spit, then you can use whatever amount of toothpaste. But we want them to have the topical access to the fluoride, because that's going to help remineralize teeth. But at the same time, we don't want to load it up so much just because simply they can't swallow.
And even adults may not need that luxurious application of toothpaste that you often see in the ads.
That's all marketing there. We don't need that much.
Okay. And again, to emphasize what you just said, there's not an age where you say you can't use a fluoridated toothpaste. It's the dose that matters.
It's the dose that matters. Yeah. Just adjusting it based on your child's ability to rinse, spit, swallow, whatever. And this is all relative to other sources of fluoride. Again, this is a discussion that we would have. So do you live in a fluoridated community? Do you not live in a fluoridated community? What other sources of fluoride do you have? There are parents who filter all of their water. You know, reverse osmosis systems can get rid of fluoride that's, you know, provided to you through the community. So we're always making adjustments or recommendations based on what exposure they do have to fluoride. There's something called the halo effect where, you know, okay, I live in this community with this level of water, but am I potentially getting more through products that are processed in different cities that did have fluoride? Mm-hmm. Are they getting fluoridated water from school or a friend's house, even though I filter my own water? So this is an important discussion to have. We want to make sure that they have good access to fluoride, but not too much at the same time.
And one other area where it's probably really important for us to collaborate, because even, you know, in a place like the Salt Lake Valley, there are a couple of pockets
there are
that where there's not fluoride, and it's not always easy to keep track of that.
And then also in this Intermountain region that we practice in, and this goes countrywide as well, there's a lot of people coming in from rural counties that may be on well water. And so they may have never had their water tested. And so there's ways to get your water tested if you don't live in a community that has access to that information. So just making sure that you have a good handle on how much fluoride exposure they have is really important.
And then there's still the ability that I used to be much more facile with to give fluoride supplement. And that's something you kind of have to keep track of age and,
right,
and all that sort of stuff. What other anticipatory guidance topics do you address with kids as they get older?
One more before we move on to older kids is when kids are little, we talk about injury prevention. As kids are learning to walk and they're starting to scoot around, we want to make sure that if something did happen where they were to fall and bump, you know, making sure that, again, we provide a dental home so we have resources that they can access in case there is an injury. So injury prevention that then progresses as they get older to athletics. We want to talk about mouth guards, you know, protecting the dentition from sports-related injuries. As kids get into their teenage years, there's always the discussions that need to happen with tobacco use and substance abuse and intraoral piercing, because damage can be done through some of those as well. And so we like to have discussions and just stay in tune with the kids as they get older. And so depending on what they're doing at any particular age can potentially have a negative impact on their oral health. And so we kind of manage those as we develop that ongoing relationship.
And as you pointed out at the first of this discussion, oral health has an impact on general health. And that's not just true of infants. That's something that follows you the rest of your life.
That's a great reason why we have a presence here at Primary Children's Hospital. You know, the healthcare providers in this institution, obviously we're dealing with some high-level children who have serious systemic diseases. You know, we play a very integral role because we want to manage pain, infection that could exacerbate some other disease process that they're dealing with. But certainly in the community, I think there's more and more evidence demonstrating that good oral health, a good biofilm, an oral microflora extends into your GI system and has impacts on a lot of other aspects of your overall health. And so we feel strongly that we need to be part of the bigger discussion with comprehensive care. And I think that as we progress medically with evidence-based care, that that's being recognized. It goes back to making sure that you as a healthcare provider are able and willing to have a discussion with the dental provider. And they want the same coming back the other direction, because we feel like we have something to contribute. And I think that just benefits the patient.
Absolutely. I get the sense that we're not that many generations removed from when people expected they would not have their teeth their whole life. And I think the combination of prevention, a good restoration, and dental care has made a big difference. And I think that that is a huge quality of life issue.
It certainly is. It progresses, and it's important on the other end of life as well in the geriatric population. You know, you get then to a state where a lot of older folks can't take care of their teeth because of maybe some physical disabilities, and periodontal disease has been demonstrated to have effects on the cardiovascular system. So it affects our life as a whole, whether it's, you know, toddlers or older folks.
I suspect you've heard this before, but as a good friend used to say, be true to your teeth or they'll be false to you.
Yeah, there you go. I like that.
Thanks, Hans. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com, and we'll address those in a couple of weeks. We'll be back next week to talk about some oral and dental emergencies. Talk to you then.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.